Hello, hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Daisy Sindelar, a writer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. Coming up in episode 13 of The Blender, we look at the remarkable life of the first man in space, Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin. Gagarin's successful orbit around the Earth on April 12, 1961, put the Soviet Union at the head of the space race and turned Gagarin into an international hero with a winning smile.
This smile wasn't just a facial expression. This smile came from the soul. And this smile really became famous throughout the world.
We also talked to Australian director Peter Weir. He says his latest film, The Way Back, about the escape of World War II-era prisoners from a Siberian labor camp, forced him to re-examine his perceptions about the crimes of the communist era.
Yeah, it's always been, you know, the human condition that has interested me. In this case, these people were suffered injustice as a result of a political system that was an incredible experiment of the 20th century.
But first, to Kyrgyzstan. On April 7th, the Central Asian nation marked 1 year since anti-government protests rocked the capital, Bishkek. The demonstrations ultimately achieved their goal of ousting President Kurmanbek Bakiyev, but the protests were also violent, leaving 90 people dead and forcing many Kyrgyz to question whether their country was changing for the worse. Ferengiz Najibullah has the story.
On April 7, 2010, hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Kyrgyz government building, or White House, in central Bishkek. Frustrated by mounting poverty and corruption, they called for the ouster of the country's president, Kurmanbek Bakiyev. But the protests soon turned violent, with shots fired on both sides. 21-year-old Asilbek Koybagarov, who had traveled from Kyrgyzstan's northern Chuy province to attend the rally, described an eruption of chaos, shooting and blood.
It was a terrifying scene. Soldiers or some kind of snipers began shooting at people from the White House. I wish I could forget that horrible sight. I was there witnessing people being killed.
Nearly 90 people were reported killed as protesters, armed with stones and clubs, clashed with police and heavily armed government troops who used live rounds to fire on demonstrators. Days of smaller protests had already rocked the country as people expressed anger over rising energy prices and unemployment. But the April 7th demonstrations took the protests to a new level, sparking days of violence and setting the stage for Bakiyev's vilification and ouster, just 5 years after the pro-democracy Tulip Revolution put him in power. Within months, the country would experience its second wave of deadly violence as ethnic clashes broke out between Kyrgyz and Uzbeks in the country's south. Many see the events of April 7th as the start of a season of chaos. A year later, those caught up in the violence say now it is an experience they will never forget. Almaz Akchekiev was an ordinary patrol officer who was deployed with dozens of his colleagues to protect the government building. But unlike the government soldiers who wore helmets and carried heavy shields, Akchekiev had no protective equipment, leaving him defenseless as angry protesters began throwing stones.
We were moving backward and I suddenly fell. I tried to get up, but I couldn't. Blood was coming from my mouth. My legs were covered in blood, too. My colleagues carried me to an ambulance and sent me to the hospital.
It was the last thing he remembers. Akchekiev woke up 2 days later to learn that doctors had amputated both of his legs. The 32-year-old father of two was told it was the only way to save his life. In all, more than 1,000 people were hospitalized in Bishkek as a result of the April 7th violence. Ernest Tilyakov, a surgeon on call at the city's National Surgery Center, says he and other doctors worked through the night as more and more victims poured in, more patients than he had ever seen.
There were young people with multiple gunshots, wounds to the chest, stomach, legs, and arms. In our center, up to 15 to 16 people were undergoing surgeries at the same time. We didn't have enough operating theaters. So on some patients, we performed surgeries on gurneys.
As doctors were treating the injured, the announcement came that Bakiyev had fled the capital for his native village of Teyit in southern Kyrgyzstan. Then the news came that the political opposition had formed an interim government, naming former Foreign Minister Roza Atombayeva as acting head. A year later, Atombayeva is president, and the country has established a new parliamentary political system. But challenges remain, with the government facing economic hurdles and doubts about its handling of the ethnic clashes in the south. Many of those affected by the April 7th violence have come away with different points of view. Koy Bagarov, the young protester, has high hopes for the new government, saying he is confident living conditions will improve. But Akchakeyev, the police officer, is not nearly so optimistic. He and his family are living in a one-room flat as they wait for the government to come through on its promise to provide an apartment equipped for his disabilities. Akchakeyev wishes he had lost only one leg. That way he could take care of himself. As it is, he says, he now depends on wife's help for everything.
That was Ferengiz Najibullah reporting on the legacy of last year's anti-government protests in Kyrgyzstan. You'll find full coverage of the Kyrgyz anniversary at our website at rferl.org. And now, an interview with Australia's Peter Weir. He's the celebrated director of such films as Gallipoli, Dead Poets Society, and The Truman Show. Weir's latest film is The Way Back. It's the epic story of a group of prisoners who escaped from a Siberian prison camp in World War II, only to trek 4,000 miles before reaching safety in India. Weir was recently in Prague, where he spoke to RFERL writer-at-large Jamie Kirchick. Kirchick began by asking Weir what inspired him to make The Way Back.
I generally tend to say no to everything, so I'd said no to it initially, although I'd enjoyed the book very much, that it became the primary inspiration, The Long Walk by Slav Rowich. But I felt I couldn't get it off my mind. It would come back to me, and I would maybe pick an odd book off the shelf, you know, to read a little more about this period, you know, which was essentially, you know, the Soviet era, although it's set in the Second World War. I found myself reading a little around it, and then read Anne Applebaum's book, Gulag, and I was drawn into it, or something. It was just irresistible, finally. And I decided, accepted to do it, and found it, one of the great experiences, I think, was the research and, you know, interviews with survivors and so on.
Yeah, in many ways, it's an adventure story, but there's certainly something of a political message in the movie, do you think? Or was that not intentional? Or
well,
was I reading into it too much? Or?
Well, I know you don't mean this, but there was a gentleman got up at a preview of question and answer time and said to me, you know, I mean, this film really basically is anti-communist. And I said, yeah. I said, I'm anti-communist and I'm anti-Nazi. I'm anti-police states, generally. Yeah, I'm not a political filmmaker, although, you know, everything is political, as somebody said. But, it's always been, you know, the human condition that has interested me. In this case, these people were suffered injustice as a result of a political system that was an incredible experiment of the 20th century. And the first thing I noted was how little I knew about it. I had to do a lot of reading. Because for my generation, growing up in the 60s, you know, we were part of, particularly the anti-war movement in Australia and, you know, as it was in America, that you came to distrust your own side's version of what was going on. And in some ways, obviously came to realise this had been the result of clever dissembling on the part of communists or communist sympathisers or apologists. And partly because of the ineptitude of the McCarthy hearings of the House of Un-American Activities that might as well have been a communist organisation. It was so brilliantly turned people against them that you grew up really thinking it wasn't as bad as it was made out to be. And that was that's a shock. And I know many of my friends from that period, we were all vaguely leftish, as young people often are, idealistic. I can't believe how gullible we were in looking back.
Movies like this aren't made in Hollywood. I mean, there's so many movies about Nazism and fascism. There's very few movies about And there's so many great stories that could be told.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, again, it's, you know, be careful, you know, if you tread on my dreams. I think in the world of creativity and even in the academic world, to a degree, that, you know, those who had their leftist sympathies when they were young, or communist sympathy, and the romance of it, found it very hard to give it up. They still sell the Che Guevara T-shirts, you know, like he was John Lennon or something. Nobody really wants to criticize Castro. It's almost impossible for a lot of people to admit that this experiment of communism went so disastrously wrong and face the fact, you know, whether it's Stalin or Lennon, for that matter. I can't let him off the hook.
Yeah.
He was all for the terror. Through to Pol Pot, you know, through to North Korea, what can you say? It's just dreadful. But there's still resistance. And I've noted that even amongst friends to this day, when I said I was making this film and what it was about, there was just that moment, just that flicker across the face of, oh, you're going along a right-wing road. And that fascinated me, that was still possible to have held onto that romance from youth.
That was director Peter Weir speaking to writer-at-large Jamie Kirchick about his latest film, The Way Back. If you'd like to read more of the interview with Weir, visit our website at rferl.org. RFERL brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. We'd love to hear from you how we're doing, so drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org. or by leaving a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
Говорить радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуш میکنی.
Машал радіо Дамінія.
Азатун ДТМ.
Радіо Азатун.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
And now we'll look not to Russia or any place else on Earth, but up to the sky, as we contemplate the 50th anniversary of man's first journey into space. The man was Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin, and as correspondent Claire Bigg reports, he was the ideal man for the times.
On April 12, 1961, a rocket blasted into space carrying Yuri Gagarin, a young Soviet cosmonaut who was about to make history as the first man in space. If Gagarin was nervous, he concealed it well. Clad in an orange protective suit, he carefully climbed into his spacecraft, the Vostok 1, which had been readied for launch in a desert steppe of Kazakhstan. He remained composed, even as the hatch closed over him. As the engines began to roar, he cheerfully shouted, «Поехали!» or «Let's go!» Gagarin's flight had been kept secret, in case the mission ended in failure. Only when it became obvious that he had made it alive into orbit did the Soviet media break the news. After a flight of 108 minutes, Gagarin safely ejected from the spacecraft. He landed in the field of a collective farm some 800 kilometers southeast of Moscow. His surreal encounter with a stunned farm worker was a moment Gagarin liked recounting.
Происходит приземление на нашей
The landing took place on our Soviet Russian land. My first encounter was with a kolkhoz worker. At first, she was a little afraid of me, but then we made friends. Just imagine, all of a sudden, a man in a bright orange suit emerges and starts walking toward her.
Gagarin's path to fame was almost as extraordinary as his space journey. Born in a remote village of Western Russia to a family of farm workers, the young Gagarin hardly seemed destined for celebrity. He entered a technical college after World War II, but soon arranged to be transferred to aviation school, where his determination quickly earned him the respect of his superiors. He was selected as one of 20 candidates for the first space flight. As the intensive training proceeded, he soon emerged as a front runner. It was not only Gagarin's hard work, but his humble beginnings that appealed to the Soviet leadership. Proof that under communism, even a peasant boy could rise to fame and success. But ultimately, it was his charm and his smile that won over Sergei Korolev, the man behind the Soviet space program. Georgi Grechko is one of the engineers who designed the Vostok spacecraft.
Korolev was wise, and he foresaw that this man would become the face of our country, of our people. So I think he also chose Gagarin for his smile. This smile wasn't just a facial expression. This smile came from the soul. And this smile really became famous throughout the world.
Gagarin's flight was a triumph for the Soviet Union in its space race against the United States. And for the 27-year-old Gagarin, it was the culmination of 2 years of arduous training that instantly earned him legions of fans across the planet. He had proven that humans could survive in space and paved the way for future manned explorations. But Grechko, who later became a cosmonaut himself, says Gagarin remains just as modest and approachable as he had been before propelling to fame.
It was right after his flight. The whole city gathered for a secret get-together to which everyone was in fact let in without any invitation. He gave us heartfelt thanks, after which a group of women with flowers rushed to him with such enthusiasm that he initially jumped back in surprise. We immediately came up with the following joke. Gagarin is asked about the scariest moment in his flight. The scariest moment was after the flight, he answers, when women threw themselves on me with flowers.
Despite the busy schedule that came with celebrity status, Gagarin insisted on continuing with his training. It was during one of these routine training flights that Gagarin lost his life. He was just 34 years old. The plane crash, in which he and his flight instructor were killed, caused an international stir and gave rise to a host of theories about what could have gone wrong during the flight. With the mystery still unsolved 50 years on, those who knew Gagarin say they are still searching for answers about the death of a friend and hero who changed the world forever. That was Claire Big on the legendary flight and untimely death of Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin. Gagarin became the first man to enter space 50 years ago, on April 12th, 1961. You're listening to The Blender, RFERL's new weekly podcast. Thinking back on Gagarin's spaceflight, as we have been this week, got us to thinking a lot about the Soviet pop culture that was inspired by Gagarin and the Soviet space program. Gagarin has been immortalized on everything: postcards, stamps, commemorative coins, and my personal favorite, watch bands. But perhaps more importantly, he's also been the inspiration for some pretty wonderful music. There are literally dozens of songs about Gagarin, or more broadly, about space. Many from the Soviet era, but some more contemporary ones as well. And we heard a bit of it in the piece we just listened to, but that just wasn't enough. So we've brought into the studio Pavel Butorin, a producer here at RFE, who is both a musician and a great appreciator of music, with the added benefit of having an encyclopedic memory. Pavel is the person that I can run to 5 minutes before deadline and say, "Do we have a Ukrainian folk song about pine cones?" And he'll always manage to find something wonderful. So, hi, Pavel.
Hi, Daisy. Thank you for the very flattering introduction.
Well, you've never disappointed me, and I'm sure that this next section is going to be the best yet. I know you've been working very diligently to whittle down a list, a long list of songs, to 5 songs, which aren't necessarily things you go home to listen to at night, but which you consider perhaps the most representative of this special Gagarin space genre. So we're going to start with a song that translates roughly as, "Do you know what kind of man he was?"
Yes, "Do You Know What Kind of Man He Was?" Many people know the song as "He Said Let's Go," and that's the chorus of the song, which echoes the words Gagarin so famously uttered during blastoff. This song was written by the most eminent Soviet songwriting duo, Alexandra Pakhmutova and lyricist Nikolai Dobronravov.
And they were husband and wife.
They were husband and wife, mm-hmm. And they were friends with the Gagarins. This performance is by Yuri Gulyaev.
Знаєте, каким он парнем был, тот, кто тропку звездную открыл. Пламень был и гром, замер космодром, и сказал негромко он. Он сказал: поехали. Он взмахнул рукой.
This sounds like a pretty classic Soviet kind of chest-thumping song. What made you select it?
Well, first of all, it's the very first song that comes to mind because it was directly dedicated to Yuri Gagarin. It also reminds me of May 1st demonstration that I used to go to when I was a kid. So that's the very first song that comes to mind.
No, it's a great one. And I think the next one we're going to listen to is by the same husband and wife team who actually wrote a number of songs about Gagarin and about space.
Although, in fact, they wrote a whole series of songs under the common title of the Gagarin Constellation, which our next song is not part of, but still.
So this next song is actually not specifically about Gagarin, but it's become very intimately associated with him. And you wrote to me in a note that come April 12th, this song will be played all over the place. And it's a very tender song called Tenderness.
It is indeed. And like you said, it's not a song that was directly dedicated to Gagarin, but it speaks about a pilot who leaves the Earth. And the song even opens with the line, "The Earth is an empty place without you." And it talks about a pilot who leaves the ground and he's in the sky. And the stars give him their tender embrace.
Опустила без тебя земля, как мне несколько часов прожить, так же падает листва в садах, и куда-то все спешат такси, только пусто на земле.
Those lyrics are especially touching given what was to happen to Gagarin. The song came out before he was killed, isn't that correct, Pavel?
Yeah, that is right. And we actually listened to the original recording by Maya Krystalinskaya, which in fact was not very well received in the beginning until it was featured in a key scene in the 1967 film Three Poplars at Plushchiha Street, where a peasant woman, played by the actress Tatiana Doronina, sings the song to Oleg Yefremov's character, a cab driver, in his cab.
And since then, it's just sort of entered the popular consciousness as both a beautiful song, but a song that's come to say a lot about Gagarin.
Oh, yes. In fact, many people think that the song is from the movie and that the song is about Gagarin, and many think of the song as a requiem for Gagarin.
Well, the next song on your list also has a movie association, if I'm not mistaken, and it is called 14 Minutes to Take Off.
Yes, that's right. And that song appeared in a 1964 comedy, which was titled Welcome But No Trespassing. It was about a pioneer summer camp where the song was somewhat clumsily performed by a bunch of kids dressed as cosmonauts during a camp recital. And again, it's not specifically about Gagarin, but it was and is very popular among cosmonauts and people in general. In fact, in the movie, during the recital, the director leans over to an important parent and says, "You know, Gagarin sang this song in space." So, I mean, it is associated with Gagarin. And interestingly, the original lyrics of the song included a line that went something like this, "Fellas, why don't we smoke a cigarette? We still have 14 minutes to take off."
Ooh, bad message.
Yes, and later it was changed, for health reasons to something like, "Let's sing a song before, you know, because we have 14 minutes to take off." Here's the song sung by Vladimir Troshin.
Заправлены в планшеты космические карты, и штурман уточняет последний раз маршрут. Давайте-ка, ребята, споемте перед стартом. У нас еще в запасе 14 минут. Я верю, друзья.
The lyrics for this song were written by Vladimir Voinovich, who would later become one of Russia's most prominent dissidents.
Oh, interesting.
The next song that I'd like to play for you always puts a smile on my face. I think the official title was something like The Voice of Earth, although everybody knows the song as I Am Earth, Я Земля, or This Is Earth, as in Radio Exchange. This performance is by folk singer Людмила Зыкина, who is reputed to be Brezhnev's most favorite singer.
Я земля, я своих не забуду питомцев, сыновей, дочерей. Долетайте до самого солнца и домой возвращайтесь скорей.
I love this song because it was just such a vivid example of this Soviet pompous anthem-like music style, and so I made my nieces actually sing the song. I would put one of my nieces on a stool, and she would sing the song. It was very funny. And but about Zikina, you had to see those performances. They were epic. I mean, she would be standing like a monument on the stage, making almost no body movements. There would be a huge orchestra with like Russian folk instruments and a huge choir behind her. And in fact, there is an asteroid named after her.
Wow.
Yes.
The ultimate compliment. Okay, we're going to move on to our very last song. And most of the songs we've heard until now have been from the 60s and 70s, but now we're going to listen to something that's slightly more contemporary. It's not entirely. It's from the 80s. But this is a song that's come to play a pretty important role in the space community. But its name, Pavel, The Grass Outside Your Home, doesn't sound like a space song.
Well, it's something that is on the cosmonauts' mind when they're out there in outer space. If you permit, I will translate the chorus of the song. We dream not of the cosmodrome rumble or this ice-cold dark space, but we dream of the grass outside our homes, green, green grass.
Земля в иллюминаторе, земля в иллюминаторе, земля в иллюминаторе видна. Как сын грустит о матери, как сын грустит о матери, грустим мы о земле, она одна. А звезды, тем не менее, а звезды, тем не менее, чуть ближе, но все так же холодны. И как часы затмения, и как часы затмения, ждем света и земные, видим сны. И снится нам не рокот космодрома, не та ледяная синева. А снится нам трава, трава у дома.
So, Pavel, you were saying that this song has come to be pretty significant for the Russian space program.
Oh, yes. So significant that in 2010, the Russian Space Agency made it the anthem of Russian cosmonautics.
That's very impressive.
It truly is.
Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week. I want to thank Pavel Butorin, music curator extraordinaire, and Tanya Kanchva, our most excellent producer, for helping to steer us through another episode of The Blender. Thanks for turning us on, and I mean that in the nicest possible sense. We're going to close out with a Gagarin song that I was actually able to introduce Pavel to. I'm very proud. The song is Gagarin by the Ukrainian band Underwood. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.
Я вас люблю.